This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, sitting in for Terry Gross. People who don't believe in God, but have an almost religious belief in causes, are at the center of the novel Dissident Gardens by Jonathan Lethem. The story begins in 1955 in Queens, New York, when Rose Zimmer, a secular Jew and a communist, is expelled from the party, ostensibly because the local committee disapproves of her affair with a black police officer. Rose is a single mother who raises her daughter Miriam to believe it's only a matter of time until the Nazis or the FBI come knocking. Miriam flees Queens and her perpetually dissatisfied mother to live a bohemian life in Greenwich Village. The characters of Rose and Miriam were inspired by Lethem's own grandmother and mother. Dissident Gardens is now out in paperback. Lethem's 1999 novel, Motherless Brooklyn, won a National Book Critics Circle Award, and his 2003 novel, The Fortress of Solitude, was a bestseller. Terry Gross spoke with Jonathan Lethem in 2013.
Jonathan Lethem, welcome back to Fresh Air, and congratulations on the new book. Why did you want to write about three generations of a family where radical political convictions and utopian ideology create more conflict within their own circles than these convictions accomplish in terms of social change?
Wow. I think that I couldn't possibly have started by wanting to do that. What I wanted to do was write about my grandmother's sex life.
So I hit the nail on the head, didn't I?
but I did. I think I did end up doing what you just said. I mean, I hope so. It sounds really great. And the thing is, you know, you don't end up where you began with a giant book, and especially one that's just so loaded up with all kinds of different things that interest and perplex me. I knew that I had a kind of a legacy. I grew up in a family of protesters, and that I'd never really gone there, and I wanted to touch it. I wanted to think about it. I also wanted to think about just, I don't know, somehow I was ready to think about my grandmother's weird, lonely, imperial existence in Sunnyside, Queens. And so those urges and those interests led me into the thicket that you just described.
Well, we must get right to your grandmother's sex life, which is really how the book starts. So why don't you read the very opening of the book?
Sure. Quit consorting with black cops or get booted from the Communist Party. There stood the ultimatum, the absurd sum total of the message conveyed to Rose Zimmer by the cabal gathered in her Sunnyside Gardens kitchen that evening, late fall 1955. Saul Eaglin, important communist, had rung her telephone. A committee wished to see her. No, they'd be happy, delighted to come to her home this evening after their own conference just across the gardens. Was 10 too late? This a command, not a question. Yes, Saul knew how hard Rose labored, what her sleep was worth. He promised they wouldn't stay long. How did it happen? Easy. Routine, in fact. These things happened every day. You could get exiled from the cause for blowing your nose or blinking at suspicious intervals. Now, after so long, Rose's turn.
Was Rose getting exiled from the party because she was having an affair with a black cop?
Well, you know, nothing is ever what it claims to be, and especially in the paranoid world of a communist cell. I mean, I think they don't really like that she's consorting with the police. And the particular policeman she's in this relationship with is a staunch, totally typical, anti-communist American, good American of the time. So he's got no sympathies to the cause. And of course, there's probably a layer of denied racism or discomfort in this group of people, right? But they would never say that it was precisely that. And Rose has aggravated them, you know, for decades by now. So they've been looking for the chance to ask her to have nothing more to do with the official operation.
So this touches on Rose, your character, sex life. Let's get really to your grandmother's sex life. Why were you interested in exploring her sex life? That's not something people usually say about their grandmothers, they're interested in.
You know, I mean, I felt that she was in love with Abraham Lincoln, and in love with...
She didn't have sex with him, I'm sure.
Fiorello LaGuardia.
Nor
and,
him.
And she couldn't get into bed with either of these guys. But I also felt she was in love with the local beat cop. That he was more than a figure of, you know, kind of public order and decency. But there was something too sexy about her admiration. And this made sense to me. She was a woman who was mostly single, even if she did have affairs. And I think she did have affairs. I don't know who they were with. And I should be really specific. I don't know who they were with. But I felt all of the things that she avowed most as kind of noble and heroic were, first of all, had a sexy quality to them, to her, that she would never have acknowledged. And the other thing was they were kind of authority figures. So this person who was a socialist was also really into presidents, cops, and mayors, and judges, and even priests, because she would sometimes talk about the, you know, if there was like a local Irish Catholic priest in Queens who was doing a lot of good for the local boys, she would be over-involved in her admiration. And I thought, this is where this person is really complicated. That she loves a man in uniform.
Do you know how your grandmother became a communist and what that meant to her during the period that she defined herself that way?
Well, here's the thing. I really don't know how she would have described her own affiliations or sympathies. In fact, I asked my father, who was the nearest resource I had, do you think that she was ever actually in a cell or, you know, a card-carrying communist is the term? And he said, with no motive to conceal anything, he said, I really don't know. And I really wouldn't know because I'm not a great researcher. And, you know, anyway, there was something liberating about not knowing. I really don't know how to find out or if there's a way to find out. I do know that there was something that my Uncle Fred thought she'd gotten wrong circa, like, 1956. He'd been taunting her all through my childhood. There was this something that Uncle Fred thought was pathetic or ridiculous in my grandmother's political life, and that she was mum on this topic. So whether she'd, you know, tried to be pro-Soviet much longer than a lot of other people tried and was humiliated, was hung out to dry by the Khrushchev revelations that, you know, kind of hit the world in 1956 and stripped the last layer of denial from even the most blinkered and idealistic pro-Soviet Americans.
The grandmother in your novel, Rose, is a communist who's kind of kicked out of the party. But what defines her more than her politics is really her paranoia and all of her fears. And part of those fears are because of the Holocaust and, you know, all the persecution that Jews faced in addition to the Holocaust. And you write that for Rose, God existed just on the puny extent he could disappoint her by his non-existence. Her anger at him was immense, almost godlike. So yeah. I'm just wondering how you think the Holocaust affected your grandmother and her relationship with God or her perception of a lack of God's presence.
Yeah. I mean, what a tormenting situation to be an intellectual woman of her generation and grow up with this enormous identity, but it was an identity founded on belief that she couldn't sustain. She was violently secular. She loved culture and she loved books and all sorts of things that Jews care for, but she couldn't believe in the Jewish God or any God. And it, you know, she felt terrible about it and she felt enraged that other people didn't see the obviousness of it all at once. But she'd substituted, I think, at some point, other kinds of beliefs. Belief in a kind of, I guess the best word is humanism. And I think if she was at any point seriously a communist, and I think probably she was somewhere in there, maybe not till 1956, that was a belief. And as anybody who studied the history of communist movements knows, it has a religious, you know, it's analogous. It draws passion out of people and sometimes irrational passion. So all of these things are muddled up for her. And then maybe some of those later beliefs become disappointed, violently disappointed as well. Other gods die. The god of literature fails her, or the god of socialism fails her. And yeah, she was paranoid and she took the Holocaust very personally, and yet it didn't belong to her the way it belonged to some other people because she was also conflicted at best about her Jewish identity.
Rose is a very gives off a very negative energy, the grandmother in the book. And as one character says of her, she was all about power, the power of resentment, of guilt, of unwritten injunctions against everything, against life itself. Rose was into death. And I'm wondering if you felt that from your grandmother and how it affected you to be around such negative energy.
Well, I think she was different ways at different times. And, in my life, which isn't what I've written about directly here, there's a before and after in my experience of my grandmother. And it's a tragic one. She lost her daughter, my mother. You know, my mother died when she was 36. I was 14. I can't work out exactly my grandmother's exact age, but she lost her only child. So there's my grandmother while my mother was still alive and healthy, and there's my grandmother after she begins to see that my mother's cancer is going to kill her. And she was a very dark person. She was betrayed. The world had betrayed her utterly. But I also think that I was very interested in the book in writing about the perplexities of seeing someone who was so into so many kinds of theoretical freedom. She embraced such diversity. That's a very bland word. But she really, diversity was like heroic to her. And that was a passion that mattered to me. But at the same time, there was a kind of control freak, a kind of intolerance of, my grandmother, for instance, was always taking me on the rare chances she could get pry me away completely. She would rush me to a barber for a haircut. Somehow it seemed like that was, whatever kind of freedom she was into, she was not into the 8-year-old boy having long hair that made him look like a girl. And so these, the different ways you can be free in your mind and free in your heart, I guess for me, Rose is an emblem of the contradictions.
Author Jonathan Lethem speaking to Terry Gross in 2013. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2013 interview with author Jonathan Lethem. The characters in his novel Dissident Gardens are inspired by his own family. The grandmother in the novel is a communist. Her daughter is a peace activist and hippie who moved away to Greenwich Village to escape the suffocating presence of her opinionated mother.
You were talking about how Rose, the grandmother, has all of these convictions about freedom and diversity, but she doesn't want her daughter to kind of have the freedom that the daughter wants. The daughter wants to leave college and go to Greenwich Village and live a very bohemian and then hippie life, which the daughter actually succeeds in doing, much to her mother's dismay. So that was like your mother. Your mother, I think she dropped out of college.
Yeah, she never finished college. Later in her life, she had this, I remember she would look at these matchbook covers for Empire State College, where you're supposed to be able to certify various kinds of life experience and get course credit for it. And she always joked that she would graduate from Empire State College from a matchbook cover. But she left Queens College, I guess, maybe as a freshman. Certainly by the time of her sophomore year, I think she'd kissed it off.
And she headed to Greenwich Village. And your mother actually knew people like Thule Kupferberg of the Fugs and the protest singer Phil Oakes and folk singer David Ronk. These were really key people. How did she get to know them?
Well, I think she just did what you could do in that generation. And that scene was small, and she was vivacious and not a shy. I guess it was almost as a teenager that she'd made her first contact with that world. And she was just in the right place.
What did your grandmother think of your mother's bohemian life?
Well, again, I'm guessing. What I got was the residue of battles long since fought, lost, won, abandoned, who knows. And, by the time I came along and could even glean that this had been controversial, it was in things that had been distilled into nice little anecdotes. But the one that I think might stand for the rest is that my parents were going to be married by the Reverend Gary Davis. He was a great blues guitarist, a blind blues guitarist who lived in Queens and was a kind of finger-picking guru to the most serious of the folk guitarists, like Dave Van Ronk. And my mother was sort of in with him, and his wife had kind of taken her in, and he was going to marry my parents, which was a really,
That's amazing, yeah.
great thing to claim, right? Mm-hmm. Well, I think at the last second, my grandmother, in a beautifully paradoxical gesture, insisted that they have a rabbi instead, which is just, it's like, you know, so I went back and I made that right in the in the book. I got the Reverend Gary Davis into the picture instead. But
that's, you know, that's a perfect example. What happened in real life is a perfect example of some of the hypocrisy that happens in the book, where somebody has this like deeply held conviction, but their actions are just the opposite of that. Like, your grandmother was so like secular to the core and so embracing of diversity, and you have this like fabulous, renowned, you know, like rediscovered, you know, African-American blues man, and like, no, she can't marry your mother and her fiancé. It has to be a rabbi.
I'll tell you a story about my grandmother that has nothing to do with the book, because it's far outside the scope of you know, once I'd invented these characters, they could only do certain things. They could contain some of these energies, but I had to, you know, I had to make the book work. But when I was in college, one of the last times I saw my grandmother, you know, well, up and living in her own apartment, I brought a girlfriend home from college. And for some reason, I made the misstep of bragging to my grandmother that I was bringing a Jewish girl to meet her, and thinking that she would just be interested in this, because I'd had in high school just before that, I had girlfriends who weren't Jewish. And my girlfriend, of course, completely secular girlfriend, and I both showed up at my grandmother's apartment, and my grandmother put on this fascinating charade of being a religious Jewish woman. I'd never seen her do anything like this before, but she suddenly was full of these weird beliefs and behaviors, and the way she served the food was every, and I didn't know what to think was going on, but she had somehow, her guilt or her confusion had suddenly dialed up this weird wrong number, and they, you know, she thought I was insisting that she be more Jewish than she'd ever been for me before. She'd served me TV dinners throughout my entire childhood.
So we've been talking about the grandmother, Rose. Her daughter, Miriam, who is the bohemian, ends up living in something of a commune. And I'd like you to read a short passage from the book. And this is actually a letter that she's written to her father, who lives in East Germany, who is separated from her mother. Long story. I don't think we'll get into that part of the story. But here she is trying to explain her living situation to her father, who she really doesn't know well because he left when she was three. And during this reading, you're going to mention the name of Tommy. Tommy is Miriam's husband, and he's a folk singer.
We live in a commune, something I suspect you wouldn't really be familiar with. Honestly, Tommy and I are like the parents, and they're like the children, so it isn't really a legitimate commune, not like the Maoist one around the corner on Avenue C, which has meetings nearly every night, and they go on for hours, and they never figure anything out. Ours is somewhere between a commune and a hostel. We started by letting Stella move in upstairs. Then we had to fill more rooms to afford to keep this place, because Tommy hasn't made any money from his records in a long time, and the money from the ACLU settlement for my wrongful arrest on public property is a distant memory. Did I ever mention I was one of the Capital Steps 13? We sued their asses. Then I spent the money mostly at Pathmark on bread and veggies and ground beef. By this time in the morning, the phone has started ringing, and usually someone has rolled a joint, and things are getting a little harder to put down in order. I mean, after the kid is off to school. I spend a lot of time listening, actually. You might not think so from this letter, which is all about me, but I do. The phone rings, or someone comes downstairs, and the kitchen is pretty much full of people for the rest of the day.
That's Jonathan Lethem reading from his new novel, Dissident Gardens. How close is that to the home that you grew up in?
Well, at times, very close. I mean, my parents did essentially turn our home into a commune. In retrospect, it seems clear to me. Although, ironically, in the way kids make distinctions, I was always very particular about it. I knew what the communes were. They were the collective households that were all over our neighborhood, because there were a whole bunch of them, where there was no family at the center of it. You know, they had a kind of a flat egalitarian rule. Everyone was an equal, and everyone was chipping in for the rent. And my parents, you know, they really were running the show. They were, in the end, they were collecting rent from people who in another context might have been called, you know, boarders. But we shared dish nights, and we shared cooking nights, and we had these consternating house meetings where grown human adults would air out their grievances to 8-year-old children as if we were all equally entitled to suffer one another's complaints. And, you know, I kind of loved it. I write about it in the book fairly affectionately, but it was, you know, certainly confusing for me in certain ways.
Author Jonathan Lethem speaking to Terry Gross in 2013. His novel Dissident Gardens is now out in paperback. We'll continue their conversation in the second half of the show. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.